Starting at noon on AM 580.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We start the program today with a remarkable story of a second chance. Cornelius Mike Anderson spent 13 years wondering when a mistake would catch up with him, until the day a SWAT team arrived at his house. Back in 1999, when he was in his early 20s, Anderson helped rob a Burger King employee. He was convicted. He went home on bail and waited to find out when he would report to prison for a 13-year sentence. But for some reason, Anderson never got word, so he went on to live a normal life. Actually, what some might call an exemplary life. He started businesses, he got married, had children, coached football, helped out at church. Last year, though, when it came time for his scheduled release, officials realized their mistake and then went to jail him to serve his full sentence. But this week, a Missouri judge sent Anderson home, praising him for achieving what the criminal justice system often does not achieve, rehabilitation. And Mike Anderson is with us now. Welcome. Welcome home.
Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate you. Thank you for having me.
How are you doing? You were telling us you were having trouble sleeping.
Yeah, I haven't slept since Sunday. I just tried to lay down and sleep last night at probably around 3 o'clock, and I couldn't, you know, just watch the wife and watch them sleep, the wife and kids. And, you know, once again, I didn't want to take the chance of going to sleep and waking up, and it was all a dream. So if I found a new way to stay in the dream, I keep it going.
I feel you. So, you know, a lot of people are probably still wondering how this happened. So let me clear this up. You did not go on the lam, right? You were not living undercover.
Not at all.
In fact, do I have it right that your previous lawyer actually tried to tell the Department of Corrections that you were not in jail? Is that true?
Yes. Yes, he tried to.
So what happened? I mean, you went home from the sentencing and they just said, just go home and wait?
Well, from the sentencing, I was sent to Fulton Correctional Facility for about 2 weeks. And from there, I bonded out on an appeals bond. And on the appeals bond, during the process over about the next 2 years, we had some court procedures that would go through, you know, certain things that the lawyers would file. And I was never required to attend. And during one of them, the judge asked my lawyer and the prosecuting attorney, where is Mr. Anderson? And my lawyer handed her his briefs. And physically stated, Mr. Anderson is currently out on bond, and gave her my address. And the prosecuting attorney then hopped up and said, no, my office checked. Mr. Anderson is currently in Fulton Correctional. Department of Corrections says that he's there. So everybody thought I was there. I hadn't talked to my lawyer in, you know, the last couple of days. And so I called him that day to see how court went. And the first thing he said was, you're not incarcerated. You're not in jail. I said, no, I'm at home. And he said, well, you need to come in and talk to me. And he scheduled an appointment about 2 days later. And when I went in to talk to him, he was like, hey, man, you know, the last 2 days I've been calling the Department of Corrections. They're saying you're there. I'm trying to tell them you're not. You know, the marshal's office won't pick you up because there's no warrant. You know, it's a mistake. I don't know how they made this mistake, but, you know, they're going to figure it out. It may take a day. It may take a month. But, you know, I don't think it'll take that long, but they'll figure out their mistake. So you just need to be prepared. You know, we can't move any further with any more appeals until they figure out their mistake. And, you know, they get you back in custody. You know, one of the questions I asked him, you know, well, are they asking me to turn myself in? He said, no, they're not asking you to turn yourself in. They're saying that you're already there.
So you just kind of went home that day and what? You just kind of waited?
I just went back home, went back to work. You know, I got into the construction field, union carpenter, and it was always in my mind. You know, I waited, like he said, I waited to be picked up like he said that I would. He said, hey, it's a mistake. They're going to figure it out. You know, I don't know how they made this mistake, but they're going to figure it out. And you know, the next couple of years were rough because I was always wondering, you know, are they going to figure it out? But then after that, it got to the point where it was kind of, you know, routine. Hey, maybe they're not. And, you know, strange stuff was happening. You know, I got pulled over one time and an officer told me that the system showed that I was on probation or parole. And I'm like, well, you know, I've never reported to a probation or parole officer. So if that's what you're telling me, hey, I'm not going to argue with you, you know. So
that was exactly the kind of thing that I was wondering, because like, you hear a lot of people who are here undocumented immigrants, right, for example.
Yes.
And one of the things you hear is that they're always looking over their shoulders thinking, okay, I can't get pulled over for a speeding ticket.
Yes.
Or, you know, they're just always worried. And I was wondering, was it like that for you?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Like I said, the first few years it was, you know, anytime just driving on the freeway or driving in traffic, you know, on the streets and a police officer just behind you, just in normal traffic, you wonder, oh, my goodness, is he running my plates? You know, or is it a bunch of them? They're about to get me. And the only few times I've ever been pulled over, you know, for non-moving violations, and they actually ran my name, took my ID, came back, gave me a non-moving violation ticket. It was always thinking, hey, are they going to know? But they never did.
Did you tell your wife?
I never told her what was going on. No, I never did. It was something that I felt.
How come?
It was a burden that I had to carry. I didn't want to put that on her. It was something that I didn't want her to carry. You know, she's got so much going on. The kids, work, you know. At one point, my wife has worked 2 or 3 jobs at a time, you know. And it was just too much for her. She's the type that she cares about everybody. And their problems become her problems. And I didn't need that. You know, I didn't want anyone else focusing on this burden that was in my life. It was something that I had to bear.
Can I be a little mean about it, though? And
go
ask
ahead.
You, mm-hmm. I'm not speaking for her. I'm just speaking as a wife.
Yes.
Is it possible, though, that this was kind of a barrier between you two? In a way, you're kind of lying. Like, it's like, in a way, like not telling about another child or something else that was a big part of your life. Do you think that might be possible?
No, I'm not going to say it was a lie because I was never asked the question, so I never denied it. And it was something that once me and my wife had got together, you know, this had already been in the background for about probably about 5-6 years. And during that 5-6 years, honestly, I didn't think about it as much as the first couple years. So it never, you know, it was in the back of my mind every now and then if something happened, you know, like I said, if a police officer would get behind me or something like that, it'd come up. But I never thought about it. I was just, you know, God just gave me such a peace that he was with me. He was going to take care of this. And being with my wife is a joy. I can't think of anything else when we're together but her, you know, her and the kids. So I never thought about it. It wasn't something that was on my mind after about the 4th or 5th year of this going on.
What was it like? I'm sorry to bring you something painful, but when the police, and I understand it wasn't just like 1 or 2.
Oh, no. It was about 8 of them.
8 of them came to your house like dressed as a SWAT team for some reason.
Oh, yeah. They had the shields, the helmets, the AR-15 rifles.
Did they bust down your door? What did they
No, they knocked. They were knocking pretty hard. You know, I was just waking up at the time they were knocking, and I was at the top of the stairs, and I looked down. I saw shadows outside, and I was like, who is it? And he said, U.S. Marshals, open up or the door's coming down. And I said, okay, let me turn the alarm off. And I turned the alarm off. And I'm like, man, there's got to be somebody playing a joke. And as soon as I unlocked the door, they already pushed it open. I put my arms up and I said, hey, man, you got the wrong guy. He grabbed my arms. He said, no, man, it's you. He's all, you remember 13 years ago. And as soon as he said that, I knew, you know. But up until that point, I thought they had the wrong guy.
What was that like for you?
It was like a nightmare. And it was embarrassing. The biggest part about this is it's been embarrassing to me, you know, especially being the man that I am now, and not really as much for me, but for my family. You know, it's embarrassing for my family, for them to be in the media and for them to have to deal with this. I have 4 children that are still in school, and kids can be cruel these days, bullying going on, and I don't want my kid being subjected to something that was me. You know, I don't want them to have to pay for my sins. The embarrassment in this was really for my family.
If you're just joining us, we are speaking with Cornelius Mike Anderson. You might have heard about him. A clerical error allowed him to avoid prison for nearly 13 years. Last year, he was taken into custody and jailed and told that he would serve his sentence. But this week, a judge sent him home early with time served. So your attorney argued that punishing you after the state's error was cruel and unusual punishment. But I have to assume that there are some people who don't agree, who think that you should have had to serve that time somehow or another, and I'm wondering what you would say to them.
I respect everyone's opinion, you know, everyone's thoughts and opinions, and I can't change the way they feel. You know, once someone's heart is hardened, it's hardened, and it's hard for people to change their mind, but everybody's got faults. No one's perfect, and, you know, sometimes those are the people that may not be able to even admit their own imperfections, but once again, I just hope and pray that they can see the man that's been here for the last 14 years and not the man where something happened 15 years ago.
Well, one person who was able to see you as you are now is the man you robbed.
Yes.
A man named Dennis. And this came to the attention of our brother, sister, public radio program, This American Life. He was interviewed. He said he was initially mad when he heard about the error, but that eventually he came to this conclusion. I just want to play a short clip from the conversation he had with our colleagues. Here it is.
He seemed to have gotten his life together. You know, you got to get the guy a little bit of slack. I mean, yeah, he screwed up when he was little, you know. But the law dropped the ball. The law ought to drop it completely. They need to leave the man alone.
What do you think when you heard that? Had you heard this before?
That's my first time hearing it.
It's your first time hearing
it? Yeah.
Did you know that he'd said that or that he'd essentially forgiven you?
I had known that the support and the things that he's saying, I didn't know about that recording. That's my first time hearing it. And it's overwhelming. It's amazing. He's a wonderful guy. And it just goes to show you the heart that he has, his character. And that's what Americans are about, forgiveness. You know, we mess up, people mess up, and we can come to forgive people, especially people that believe in God. You know, we can forgive people, and he's amazing for that. And I just appreciate him, his comrades, and all his support that he's given throughout this.
I think the other thing that a lot of people listening to our conversation, listening to you, will be interested in is, what do you think turned things around for you? Like, I don't know what it is that brought you to want to rob this guy. I don't know what was going on with you, that what made you want to rob him then or be part of that then. But what do you think turned it around for you?
I gave my life to God. You know, I got in that word, got in the Bible, and I saw his forgiveness, his love for me, and what he had did for me, his son dying for me. And I had to give him my life, and he turned it around. You know, I just give him all the honor, glory, and praise. I'm not smart enough to, you know, everybody here, everybody saying he rehabilitated himself, but I give God the glory for that, you know. So now I just give him the glory and the praise, and I just thank everyone for their support. I couldn't have gotten this far without the support of the public and my family and friends and loved ones.
Cornelius Mike Anderson is a master carpenter. He is a husband and a father and now a free man. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up, more high school students are making it across the graduation stage, but that doesn't mean they're ready for college-level courses.
It's easy to lose your momentum, especially if you happen to be a student who maybe isn't sold on the whole idea of college in the first place.
We'll hear how one professor kept that momentum going by turning summer break into math boot camp. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
On the next Nazi Mega Weapons on WILL-TV, explore the most technologically advanced plane of World War II, the Messerschmitt ME-262, a fighter jet that inspired a revolution in aerial warfare. Learn the remarkable story of the awe-inspiring aircraft and the battle for air supremacy that decided the fate of the war. Watch Jet Fighter ME-262 on the next Nazi Mega Weapons, tonight at 9 on WILL-TV.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Trophy Time in Champaign. Trophy Time features a variety of items that are recyclable or made from recycled materials, like shopping bags, bag clips, and key tags. More information can be found at trophytime.com. Trophy Time, they're more than just trophies.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's turn now to South Africa, where elections are being held today. 20 years ago, the country went to the polls for the first democratic elections after the end of apartheid. But this election is taking on some additional poignance because this will be the first time the so-called born free generation, those born after the end of apartheid, will be going to the polls. The ruling African National Congress is expected to retain its hold on power, but that's accompanied by very real disappointment after a series of scandals involving the party and the current president, Jacob Zuma. We wanted to hear more, so we've called Theryl Hafiji. She is the editor of the City Press newspaper in Johannesburg, and we speak to her from time to time about events in South Africa, and she's with us now again from their offices. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much, Michelle.
You know, I think a lot of people in this country remember that famous quote from former Archbishop Desmond Tutu after he voted for the first time, saying that it was a wonderful feeling, like falling in love. What is the sentiment today?
Everything I read, I've just come back from voting myself. There's a very festive atmosphere around the voting stations. And I think that even 20 years later, for many of us, it's still something of a novelty, and we know how hard won it was.
It's a public holiday, is it not?
Yes, it has been declared a public holiday.
And what are the expectations for turnout?
The turnout is lower than the Uhuru or the Freedom election of 1994, where there it was unprecedented at something like 89%. I think we're becoming quite normal now. Worst case scenario is a 54% turnout. I'm certainly hoping that it will be higher than that.
As I mentioned, that this is the first time that those born after the end of apartheid will have the opportunity to vote. And we wanted to hear what some of them thought about voting, so we called a number of people. Here's Deirdre Engelbrecht. She's a 20-year-old student at the University of Johannesburg, and this is what she told us.
As a young person, I feel that this election today, marking 20 years of apartheid, it's a big thing because we are now part of it, and we do have the power to change it ourselves.
Is that a prevailing sentiment among many of the born free generation from what you've been able to determine?
You know, I'm very happy to have heard young Deirdre speaking so excitedly about elections, but the sad big picture is that lots of young people didn't even register to vote. They're the largest cohort of those people who didn't register to vote. We certainly are hoping that by the time the results come in on Friday, those who did register actually went and made their X today. We were speaking about the Archbishop Desmond Tutu earlier. I was just reading a piece and watching a beautiful picture of him with his walking stick in a very jaunty beret on going to cast his vote. And his message to young people is that they shouldn't become blasé about voting. I think very much speaking to the youngsters who you call the born frees.
Well, in fact, you know, we talked to another young woman named Cindy Dubé. She's a 19-year-old student at Wits University. This is what she told us along those lines.
So many of my friends aren't even going to vote, and so many students are not going to go vote because of the fear and the possibility that we could be failed or we could be let down by these parties.
What do you think that's about?
It's a global pattern. You see the same thing in Greece, in Spain, perhaps even in the U.S., where increasingly young people don't feel like their voice can be effectively exercised by electoral politics casting your vote once every 5 years. Instead, they're more excited by movements, by different kinds of citizen action, even by social media as a form of a citizenship and social activism. The additional issue we face in South Africa is I do think there are 3 million young people who are unemployed and have never had a job. And for them, I think the country feels like something they look into rather than something they're a part of. And I certainly hope that's going to be right at the top of the minds of politicians' agendas come next week.
We are told, though, that President Jacob Zuma of the African National Congress, which is the party of Nelson Mandela, does appear to be headed for another 5-year term, and the party is also expecting a decisive win in the legislature as well. How is that possible if there's this widespread discontent? And while you're at it, why don't you tell us a little bit about what the source of discontent is?
President Jacob Zuma, I think, has done good things in health and education, specifically fighting AIDS in a far more committed, coherent way than his predecessors, including Nelson Mandela, had done. In education, similarly, it's beginning to change very slowly, but it is changing. Unfortunately, his has been a presidency besmirched by scandals, the last of which is a massive, massive payment on his private home that has, I think, fairly much dogged the governing party in the election campaign. Yet he is still going to be president for the next 5 years. Undoubtedly, he's fought a confident and very long campaign. Figures are showing up that he's less popular than the governing party is, but the ANC of Nelson Mandela is still, I think, the party of the very clear party of the majority in South Africa.
Mr. Zuma does have challengers. I understand that Julius Malema, founder of the Breakaway Economic Freedom Fighters, is one of the stories of the election. Could you talk a little bit about him?
Sure. I was just looking at a picture now. Julius Malema voted in the north of the country. He attended a polling station with his granny holding her hand. It's very much been his campaign, Michelle. Young man, early 30s, has really brought his party right to the forefront of the black imagination in South Africa. I think he fought it on the idea of economic freedom, that while South Africans may have attained political freedom, they haven't attained economic freedom. And polls are suggesting he'll get about 4%, not a bad showing for a very, very new party that has only started a few months before the campaigning began.
I have a short clip of him speaking, and I'll play it for you, and then you can tell me what you think.
Like this generation, we have our own generational mission, that of fighting for economic freedom in our lifetime. Our mission is a mission to restore the dignity of African masses.
What is the core of his message? Is it generational? It's time to move on from the anti-apartheid fighter generation, which was Nelson Mandela's generation. Is it primarily a racial appeal, or is it an economic equality appeal? Is it all those wrapped up together?
Probably all wrapped up together. A little bit of context is important. He used to be the leader of the youth wing of the governing party. He was pushed out after he began to take sides against President Jacob Zuma. He was expelled and then started his own party. Many commentators at the time thought it would go nowhere. In fact, he's proven them completely incorrect. His party members wear red berets and kind of red, I think, after Hugo Chavez, who was a real hero of his, red overalls, red berets. They call themselves Chavistas. And I think his campaigning is very much borrowed from that model, quite radical. Lots of nationalization, lots of expropriation of land, and a message that has resonated with many, many South Africans, not only poor and working class one, but middle class people as well.
Is there a candidate that has support across racial lines?
I think the party that's going to come out with the best cross-racial result this time around is probably the second largest party, the Democratic Alliance. They fought quite hard for the economic heartlandia, the province in which Johannesburg is based. Polls suggesting they're going to be the big winner of this election, coming out 6 percentage points higher than they did the last time around. They've told me that those new wins will be in black areas. That would make them the largest cross-racial party. The ANC, the governing party, really tried at the beginning of the campaign to make itself a party for all, but right at the end of it, our calculations show that it's still the party of the black majority, really.
If Mr. Zuma is reelected, as it appears that he will be, and the party maintains its hold on the legislature, what will be their mandate over the next 5 years?
They've made that pretty clear, and it is that economic redistribution has to begin properly. So whether that be in the workplace, whether it be the redistribution of land, but we have to complete that work, what they call the second phase of freedom. Difficult to do in an economy that's not growing as fast as it should be to enable the country to make those kind of policy measures.
Ferial Hafaji is the editor of the City Press newspaper. She was kind enough to join us from her offices in Johannesburg, South Africa. Ferial, thank you so much for speaking with us once again.
Thank you so much for your time.
Let's turn to another subject that interests us very much, which is education. Now, we've talked on this program before about how more students are graduating from high school today without basic skills in subjects like reading and math. And some students have to take years of remedial courses so that they can catch up, and that's in college. And that can be discouraging and expensive. So some professors have been coming up with creative ways to get their students up to speed. Eric Hoover recently wrote about one such effort at the University of the District of Columbia for the Chronicle of Higher Education, and he is with us now to tell us more. Welcome, Eric. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You wrote about a summer math program that was taught by Professor Dariel Khatri of the University of the District of Columbia, or UDC, and his colleagues there. And it started because he saw his students struggling with the same basic skills over and over again. And we talked to him briefly this morning, and this is what he told us.
So we went after those skills from the very beginning, many basic math skills. The multiplication table, 1 through 15, became a way of life for them every single day. Starting at 10 o'clock until 2, it was all algebra, algebra, algebra. Basic math, basic math, basic math.
Now, tell us how he came up with this idea. I mean, he's a physics professor, so he's not a... This is not his thing. He's not trained in, you know, remedial math or any of those things. How did he come up with this?
Well, he's a physics professor, but he has been a lifelong math whiz. And he saw just some basic holes in students' ability to do basic math. And this would prevent them from going on to major in something like physics. If you don't have the math skills, you're not going to be able to cut it, and you would never be able to major in physics at UDC. And so he saw this as something that he had to address, because for no other reason, he wanted to get more physics majors. He wanted to see more people who were competent and confident enough in their math skills to go on and major in physics or any other science at UDC.
Now, the way a lot of institutions address these deficiencies is with remedial courses that students take along with their other coursework. What was his thinking about the benefit of this approach, this kind of deep dive boot camp? I mean, he sounds like a drill sergeant, actually.
Absolutely. I think the key word here is momentum. If you are starting off your college experience in a remedial course, or maybe more than one, it's easy to lose your momentum, especially if you happen to be a student who maybe isn't sold on the whole idea of college in the first place. You're very scared about it. You lack confidence as a student. And then you're in this remedial course. It can be very, very demoralizing for students. And so his thought was, if we can start them in the summertime, we can drill down and get them ready for their first semester, they can hit the ground running and have more momentum.
You focused much of the piece on one student, Marquin Davis. What's his story?
So he was a student who just kind of coasted through high school, didn't really pay much attention, had no desire to go to college. He had a job. He thought, this is what I'm going to do with the rest of my life, make money, buy a car, that's it. And this professor really reached him and saw that he had potential and saw that he was curious. So the professor stayed on his case and eventually convinces him to come to UDC and major in physics.
Major in physics. Well, this is particularly striking to me because you describe this one scene where on the first day of class, he comes in and puts his head down on the desk. I mean, this is the kind of thing that just would make some people crazy, and they would just throw him out. I mean, so what made him stay? What made Professor Khatri stay on his case?
Well, I think part of it was years earlier in his first teaching experience, he figured out a way to reach students who were unruly, who were troublemakers, who didn't seem to want to be there. And I think he carried this with him for many years. So when he saw Marquin Davis put his head down on the desk, he figured that he could reach this kid. He was confident. He's a professor who's full of confidence. He wasn't going to let this knucklehead stay a knucklehead very long. And I think he just was relentless and didn't give up on him. And I think that's what drew me to this story. Marquin Davis was a student that I think many teachers and professors perhaps reasonably would have given up on early on.
Well, he clearly had potential, but it was almost as if he was determined not to use it. Not to use his potential or just to kind of not push himself.
I think that's right. And I think that has to do with fear or lack of comfort in an academic setting. And that's what you often find in remedial courses. Students just don't lack the basic skills in a given subject. They just don't see themselves as college students. That's a frightening concept.
So one of the things that was interesting to me about this story is the University of the District of Columbia, UDC, is not one of these places that gets written up in academic journals as kind of a center for innovation. What is the message here? Is the message here about one particularly creative and energetic teacher? Or is it that there are specific techniques that other people could emulate if they put their minds to it?
I think any professor could take something from this experience that Dr. Khatri had, and that is to ask yourself as a teacher, does your responsibility, at least to certain students, extend beyond the boundary of the classroom? And this professor decided that it did. It's one thing to think of a new and innovative way to drill down and to really teach math skills in a different way. But for some students that this professor has taught, he has taken a larger view that they need help with more than just those skills. They need to come to see themselves as successful, confident college students. And he decided as a professor that he needed to do more than just teach them during the class period, that he had to do a lot in between classes too, that had a lot more to do with subjects other than math than just teaching math skills.
Well, you know, to that end, that was the final question I had. I think it is worth mentioning that as part of this kind of summer boot camp, academic boot camp, there was a lot of intensive mentoring that the students who passed this course, if they re-enrolled and went through the academic year, they were guaranteed a lot of support.
That's right.
I understand it.
Mm-hmm. The students who went on from that program to major in science basically were boxed in by Dr. Khatri and another professor so that they had no real wiggle room. They had to have their homework assignments checked. They had almost daily, if not daily, check-in meetings. At the end of the week, they weren't allowed to leave the campus unless they showed that their homework assignments were completed. The professors call themselves academic parents, and the idea was that as long as those students were on the campus, they had a mom and a dad, quote-unquote mom and dad, who were looking out for them and helping them learn to get in the habits that they needed to become successful students.
Eric Hoover is a reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education. His piece is called The Human Variable in Teaching. Eric, thank you.
Thank you.
Just ahead, you might have heard about a new campaign by the White House to fight sexual violence on college campuses.
It's up to all of us put an end to sexual assault. And that starts with you.
We wondered how students are reacting to the campaign and what they're really saying to each other about sexual assault. So we're going to ask. Our diverse roundtable of students is coming up on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, offering genomic testing that may reveal other treatment options for individual cancer patients at cancercenter.com. From LifeLock, reminding consumers that individuals with good credit are often targets of identity thieves. Learn more at lifelock.com/NPR. From the Pajamagram Company, offering women's pajamas and gift packaging delivered overnight and for Mother's Day at pajamagram.com. And from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, seedy casinos, inveterate gamblers, and high-stakes poker. Author Colson Whitehead tells us how a magazine recruited him to enter the World Series of Poker as an amateur and report on the experience. He trained in Atlantic City and ended up at the tournament in Las Vegas playing for a chance at millions of dollars. Whitehead's new book is called The Noble Hustle. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. This week on Latino USA, what happens when domestic violence affects all the members of the family?
What we really need is a campaign to let families know that they can seek safety now without leaving their pets behind.
That's this week on Latino USA.
Saturday evenings at 8 on AM 580.
Support comes from the Prairie Ensemble, presenting their next concert on Saturday, May 10th at McKinley Presbyterian Church in Champaign. The international program will feature Kodo soloist Yoko Recano Kimura and Mendelssohn's Italian Symphony. The concert starts at 7:30 with a concert conversation at 7. Details at prairieensemble.org.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We'd like to turn now to something you or a student or a family you know might have been talking about lately. A lot of educators and officials seem to be talking a lot more about this subject lately. It's the issue of sexual violence on college campuses or involving college students. The Department of Education recently released a list of 55 colleges and universities that they say are under investigation for mishandling sexual assault claims. The White House has also created a task force of educators educators, advocates, and students to create strategies to deter sexual assaults and to assist victims. We wanted to know whether these methods are resonating with students and whether they're actually relevant to the world these students are actually living in. So we've called a group of young people whom we know have been thinking about this issue and working on this issue on different campuses. They are Matthew Scott. He is a senior at George Washington University. He's the president of GW Students Against Sexual Assault. Welcome. Thanks for coming.
Thank you for having me.
Kate Parkinson Morgan is a student at UCLA. She's also the digital managing editor of the Daily Bruin. That's the student newspaper where she's been covering the topic of sexual assault on campus. Kate, welcome to you. Thank you for coming as well.
Thank you for having me.
Malik Washington is the executive director of the William Killebrew Foundation. He's also a Men of Code facilitator. That's a mentorship program for teenage boys. He was also a residential advisor at Howard University, from where he recently graduated. And he's been with us from time to time to talk about these issues before. Malik, thanks for coming back.
I'm sure.
Also with us, Kenna Smith. She is a senior at the University of New Hampshire, and she's also the outreach assistant for the school's Sexual Harassment and Rape Prevention Program, or SHARP. Kenna, welcome to you. Thank you for coming also.
Thank you so much for having me.
And this is probably a good place to mention that the fact is this is a sensitive topic, and we're going to be talking about some things that might be difficult for some people to hear. So with that being said, I'm just going to start. Well, why don't I start with you, Kenna? Just tell me how you got interested in this subject. Why did you start working on this?
I actually started because of a friend of mine who was assaulted at a different campus, and I am a social work major, and they had an internship opportunity to work with SHARP, so I took the advocate training to run the crisis line, and I've been here for 4 years.
Been there ever since. And Matthew, also, what about you? You were mentioning that you and your roommate, your freshman year, are the only two men involved in this group on your campus. What got you interested in it?
We really were, and I became interested because my roommate was interested, and I think this is an important issue to address, so... Mm. That's definitely why I'm interested.
Okay. And Malik, what about you? Has this been a big issue for you in your time as a mentor, an advisor to young men, and perhaps for you yourself, you're a recent graduate?
Absolutely. I mean, victimization is a big part of our organization at WKF, but even as a RA, it was something that was whispered about and not necessarily talked in the open. And then I heard far too many stories of young women that I knew who were assaulted on campus, and oftentimes by people that they knew. So it's certainly very personal in that way.
And Kate, I'm going to ask you as a reporter how you got interested in this issue. I note here that, you know, the Justice Department data says that 1 in 5 women in college report having been a victim of sexual assault or an attempted assault. And I was just wondering what got you into that. Does that number resonate with you?
It certainly does. About 6 months ago, a student activist on campus at UCLA reached out to me. She had about 6 survivors of sexual assault who wanted to speak to the university newspaper about their experience and where they felt wronged in the reporting process, or if they didn't report at all because of the environment on campus.
And so, and was that the first time you'd heard this? Because the activists came forward, or what?
Obviously, sexual violence has been an issue on campus for a very long time, but the student activist came and talked to me and said that there are 6 survivors who really wanted to speak about their experiences, and they didn't feel like they were being heard by the university. So I reached out to them and talked to them for about 6 months about their experiences and recently published that article.
So briefly, Kate, I'm just going to give me a couple of the scenarios that you reported on, if you would.
Sure. A lot of the stories are very graphic, but one story I feel like I can share on the radio is the story of one woman who, freshman year, was assaulted twice on 2 different occasions by 2 different people. She was incapacitated at both times, meaning she was drunk to the point where she couldn't give consent. And that is considered rape under California Penal Code. It's a crime. She reached out to our university counseling center to speak about how she was feeling, not explicitly about the assault. She was also homesick. She was a freshman. When she spoke about the assault and what had happened on that night of the second assault, her counselor responded, "Yeah, I can see how you'd feel like a piece of trash after that." She told me she was too ashamed to go back for more help from the counseling center. She's still dealing with a lot of self-blame and guilt about the incident.
Hmm. You know, Kenna, your school, the University of New Hampshire, was one of the 3 that was invited to join this White House task force.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the kinds of conversations that your school is going to be bringing to that? I mean, is that the experience that Kate just reported there? Is that something that people are saying has been common? So,
A lot of our survivors come forward, and the number one date rape drug that we tell our students at UNH is alcohol. and being incapacitated by alcohol. And so a lot of those stories do resonate with what we do see here on campus. And how we talk about that is we do a lot of programming in residence halls around what consent is. And so just as she had said before, talking about the fact that if you are incapacitated by alcohol, you cannot give consent, and telling that to both male and female students and the LGBTQ plus, just making sure that everyone knows like what, how to have a safe and healthy relationship and what is consent and how to have healthy sexual relations with other students. So we do a lot of conversations around that and how to focus in on really reaching students, as you said before, in a realistic manner and telling them what that really looks like.
So, Matthew, what kinds of conversations? I'm particularly interested in what kinds of conversations the guys are having, because often we've been hearing from a lot of women who are coming forward with these very negative experiences. But what about some of the conversations you're having with young men? What are they talking about?
Well, I guess the difficulty is accessing the young men so they have those conversations in the first place, so they're few and far between to begin with. But when those conversations happen, it's more of that informational talk about, yes, this is sexual assault, and yes, this is wrong. The trouble is really transferring knowledge into action.
Well, tell me more about that. I mean, what are you saying, first of all? You're saying that it's hard to get young men to participate in these conversations? I mean,
oh,
does
definitely.
GW require anything? Is there any kind of training or experience that's required for everybody to participate in?
GW doesn't have anything that's required. They do have the orientation program, which has a skit about sexual assault that goes on for about 5 minutes, but that's within a cluster of a lot of other skits on a ton of other topics, as you could imagine.
Malik, what about you? What do some of the young guys talk to you about if they bring this up? Do you have to bring it up generally?
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, when we talk about sexual assault with young men, it's most often in the terms of the legal parameters. What could get them in trouble? What is considered sexual assault by the law? But unfortunately, and I think this is a little bit what Michael was alluding to, is that we can talk about what sexual assault is, but there's a whole bunch of space that happens, things that happen before you even get to that point of knowing, okay, this is sexual assault. So how do you actually put that into action? How do you actually tell young men and young women and let them know where they should draw the line? And so the personal responsibility piece, you know, we don't want, it's not just about telling women not to get drunk. Unfortunately, too many people have used that as a way to blame victims. But we also have to tell young men to watch their alcohol intake and how much drugs they are using for the fear or the sake of them doing something that they may not even realize is wrong.
How do they feel about that? I mean, do they feel angry about that? That they feel like all the responsibility is on them now? Or how is that playing out? Because, you know, with young women, we've heard a lot now about women not wanting to be blamed and slut shaming
exactly.
And not blaming the victim, because I think for a long time the working social assumption has been if something bad happens to a girl, it's her fault.
Right.
So there's been a lot of pushback against that.
Right.
Are the young men saying it's gone too far now, everything's my fault?
I don't think that young men are angry, at least from my experiences, but they are a little confused and they want some more understanding. And I think that this is part of that misunderstanding that leads to a lot of these assaults in the first place, that their bodies are not treated in the same way. A lot of them don't understand how they can be in a situation in which they're both inebriated and the other person cannot give consent, but they can, even though they are drunk. And so some states it's different, in some places it's different, but that's not always the case. And so they have a lot of confusion about that, and I think that leads to them sometimes being in these situations.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about sexual assault on university campuses. The White House is making a new push on this. We're talking about this with a group of students, or recent graduates, and all of them are people who've worked on this issue or reported on this issue as students or advised on this issue. Matthew, what about that? Do the people you're talking to, do they feel confused or what? What are some of the kinds of conversations you have around this?
Right. Well, we would try to meet people where they are, especially when we're talking to men. When we talk to men, I definitely want to make sure to address masculinity. I was involved with a group called Men Can Stop Rape, and we had a Men of Strength club similar to what Malik mentioned, the Men of Code club. And we talk about masculinity and its impacts on behavior, for instance, and so how certain things might be acceptable within certain settings is what we generally discuss.
So, Kenna, is the main focus of education on your campus around consent and the importance of giving consent and getting consent? Do you feel like that's the main takeaway?
That's one thing, but we also want people to understand what sexual assault is.
Okay, now what about you?
Yes, that's part of what we do. We do programming around consent, around domestic violence, sexual violence, also around how the university views consent and how we can talk more about what alcohol and how alcohol affects your sexual relations while you're going out on campus. And I mean, specifically,
and is this focused on both young men and young women?
Yes, it's focused on both young. Yeah.
Can I ask you this, Karen? I apologize because I realize some people might be offended by the question, but I do have to ask. It's similar to the question I was asking Malik earlier. Do you, as an advocate, do you ever feel a concern that by focusing on checking the behavior of young men, are you ever worried that this kind of releases young women from taking some responsibility for their behavior and protecting themselves and their friends, like keeping each other safe and taking whatever steps they should take to stay safe? Do you see my...
Personally, what we like to focus on at Sharp is when we talk about responsibility, we say the only person responsible for a sexual assault is the person perpetrating the sexual assault. And here at the University of New Hampshire, in our conduct policy, the way that it's written is that you have to seek and receive express consent. And the way that's drawn to make sure that there's no assumptions is the person who's initiating a sexual act.
But so how do you enforce that? I mean, how is that enforced? I mean, because typically, aren't a lot of these incidents taking place, perhaps most, when people are alone, so together. So how do you enforce such a thing? I mean, how do you know who's telling the truth?
I know, and that's why we have a conduct board, and that's if you're going through the university policy, and if you're going through criminally, we have forensic interviews where they ask people to tell their stories. And if you're going through the UNH conduct policy, one question that they will ask is, when did you ask for consent, or how did you ask? And what we hear a lot of is, well, I assume that since we were making out that this was okay and that we were going to have sex, or I assume because someone let me into their room that we were going to have sex. And so that's kind of how we break it down through our university policy of saying, okay, well, did you ask? And it's not even the question of did you ask, it's more than that. It's saying, did you ask, and did you receive a verbal response back, so a yes or something more along those lines.
So, Kate, how are these new White House guidelines, or this whole initiative, how is that going over? Have you had a chance to report on that? What reactions are you getting to this?
Well, last time I spoke to our Title IX officer, she hadn't looked at the report. That was the day my story was published, and she was just about to look at the report. One of the things brought up in the report, though, is talking about a climate survey. There was a recommendation that all colleges survey their students, especially survivors, and ask them about their experiences and how they're feeling about reporting at the university, whether they feel comfortable reporting at their university when they are assaulted. I think that's a really important recommendation brought up by the report. You know, a lot of the people I spoke to were saying that they didn't feel like they could go to university administrators or university police and tell them about how they felt wronged. They didn't feel listened to. They didn't feel like they could talk about how they were affected by the insensitive comments they received, why they felt discouraged from reporting. So I think that is a really important part of that White House task report, is surveying students like our university paper did, reaching out to survivors, asking them what they feel like needs to be done, what needs to be changed, and doing that on a regular basis. I feel like that needs to be something that the university start doing.
Well, let me ask all the people who are about to move on. I mean, Matthew, you've been working on this for some years now, right? And you're about to move on. What would you like to have happen, you know, at your campus after you go?
I wish it would happen today, to be honest. But I really would love mandatory education for all students, especially first-year students, since female freshmen are most at risk, statistically speaking. And then I also want to make sure that students know their resources and know where they could get help. Those are really the two key things that I'm thinking of.
Kenna, what about you? What would you like? You're about to move on to, and congratulations to my graduating seniors.
Congratulations
for all you've done. But Kenna, what about you? What would you like to have happen at your campus now after you go?
Well, luckily, we are just instituting our mandatory first-year education for sexual assault that Matt was talking about. So that's going to start at the junior orientation. So I'm glad that that's coming. So all incoming freshmen are going to be able to go through the training. But something I'd like to see is just, you know, a little bit more campus involvement. We do a lot on campus. And, I mean, we have so many volunteers at our program, but I would love to see that even increase even more. So there's more of a response from our campus, and we do a lot of programming. But having more people get involved is just better for our campus and better for the cause.
Malik, what about you? You're a recent graduate, and you're still kind of keeping your hand in as a mentor working with the William Killebrew Foundation. What are some of the things you'd like to see happen, maybe as a result of the conversations that are going on now?
Right. I know what I'd like to see happening is already happening, and I know specifically at Howard, they have a grant to provide this type of training to young men and incoming freshmen about sexual assault. But I would really like to see things happen way before college even happens. The same time we start talking to young men and women in high school about sex, they also need to be learning about sexual assault. And I know when I was there, I was not. And by the time they're in college, a lot of them have already begun certain sexual behaviors and habits that can be difficult to break. And so we need to start much earlier.
Kate, I'm going to be looking forward to more reporting from you on this topic, so I'm not going to ask you for an opinion as my fellow journalist in the conversation. So,
thank you very much.
Malik Washington is a recent graduate of Howard University, where he was a residential advisor. He's now the executive director of the William Killebrew Foundation. Matthew Scott is a senior graduating at George Washington University. He's the president of GW Students Against Sexual Assault. They were both here in Washington, D.C. Kenna Smith is the outreach assistant for the Sexual Harassment and Rape Prevention Program at the University of New Hampshire. She was with us from the studio on that campus. And Kate Parkinson Morgan is the digital managing editor of the UCLA student newspaper, The Daily Bruin. And she was kind enough to join us from NPR West. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.